You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere. Here are your hosts, Anthony Kestrovince and Phil Rogers.
Hello, this is Phil Rogers, MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. And the Central's been all about those Royals, really finally getting everything together with their potential, passing the Tigers for first place in the division, and now the Royals are talking about home field advantage. They want to have the best record in the American League. Very impressive. You know the Tigers are going to come back, and we also have the Cleveland Indians in that division very much alive in the wild card race. I'd like to bring in Dick Cagle now, Kansas City Royals beat writer for MLB.com. And Dick, when you point to the lineup that it allowed them to win 15 of 18 after they played Minnesota over the weekend, what do you point to for just the consistent at-bats that they're getting up and down that order?
Well, it is consistent, Phil, and that's the secret. There hasn't been just one or two guys. It's been all up and down the order. And from Nori Aoki leading off, down through Infante and Billy Butler and Salvador Perez on down the order, Alex Gordon. It's just not one guy. That's been the true secret, and they've been able to overcome the loss of Eric Hosmer, who was, of course, their hottest hitter when he went down with a hand injury. So, it's that consistency, and that's what they're looking for in baseball, of course, is consistency. And when you get consistency, particularly in your batting order, you tend to win a lot of ball games, because runs just keep coming in, and that's what's been happening so far. And if they can keep that going, I think they're going to be all right through September.
DK, and Josh Willingham, Raul Ibanez, Scott Downs, Jason Frazier, you had this note. These guys have a combined 54 years of service time in the big league. So the Royals got older, more experienced in a hurry. And those aren't their core players, obviously, but obviously some nice pickups from the experience front. But I want to ask you about Willingham, who made an immediate impact in his first week. He had three doubles and a home run. There's a guy who a couple weeks before the Royals maybe might have shied away from the price, but the S price on the part of the Twins. But, a couple weeks later did bite the bullet and paid that price to get him. Does it just seem like this is the guy they got at the right time? I know he's had some injury issues and some struggles with consistency himself offensively this season, but does this seem like the right guy at the right time?
Yeah, he really brought in a spark. Josh Willingham, the first pitch he saw from John Lester, boom, line drive double into left field, and he's been pretty good ever since. There's been a strikeout or two and a double play, but he is a real force, I think, in the lineup, and the willingness of the Royals to pick up that $1.8 million that was left on his contract with the Twins shows that they're really serious about going down the stretch with this guy, and the other veteran guys they brought in. It was interesting because a statistic came out not long ago, and that was even before they got Willingham, that the Royals had suddenly become the second oldest team in the major leagues, second only to the Yankees, averaging over 30 years of age. So it's not the young, inexperienced Royals anymore. It's some young core players, but surrounded with some veteran, some heady, experienced players that can help them along in this really new experience for them, being in the playoff hunt down the stretch.
I know earlier in this the second half, talking to Ned Yost, this was just before, actually, they took off when they were in Chicago after the All-Star break, and he was talking about how the hitters just needed to relax, that they weren't going to be a playoff team unless they started to hit, but they had the ability there to hit.
They just needed their guys to relax and kind of trust it. Is there anything to point to? I guess it's the proverbial chicken-egg question, which happened first, the success or guys relaxing a little bit. But, I don't know if it was the addition of some of that veteran talent that came in or because it did coincide with actually losing Eric Hosmer, which is the odd thing. He was the hottest hitter in their lineup, and he goes out, and all of a sudden, this kind of team-wide hitting started. Is there an explanation, or is it just one of those stretches that happens in baseball?
Well, it may be a coincidence, but you were talking about the series in Chicago, and that's, of course, when Hosmer's injury became serious, and also when they happened to have a players-only team meeting during that weekend. And I don't know exactly what was said or even approximately what was said, but I do know that Raul Ibanez, of course, the real veteran and respected leader, stood up and made some comments. And I don't know what he said, but apparently it took hold. And from that point on, yeah, you're right. The players have seemed more relaxed, maybe just the way they're approaching the games, the way they're approaching their at-bats. But from that point on, they have taken off. And it's one of those mysterious things. Do team meetings really work? I don't know. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But apparently this one happened, and whether it was coincidence or not, the team took off, and you're right, everybody seemed more relaxed about it, more willing to, approach the games day by day, relax a little bit. They win, great, and they kept winning. So maybe that was it, Phil. I don't know.
Well, those galvanizing moments help, but it also helps when your top three relievers, your seventh, eighth, and ninth inning relievers combine for a less than half a point ERA over the course of about 2.5 months, going back to June 25th. That's the mark of Greg Holland and Wade Davis and Kelvin Herrera. DK, do you think those guys – is that going to be the balancing act for Ned Yost as we get into the home stretch of the season here? Is obviously, those are guys you want to ride, and those guys – have been hugely important to them this season, but also you want to be careful not to overwork them down the stretch, I imagine, as well.
Exactly. And, he is going to ride those three guys, but he's very careful not to ride them too hard. Over the last weekend in Minneapolis, for example, he was very careful to get Wade Davis and Greg Holland a couple of days' rest in a row because he sensed that they were getting a little weary. Maybe they're not working each and every day, but they're working often enough that when he does work them 2 days in a row, he can see a little weariness. And he doesn't want Herrera and Davis and Holland to have any signs of fatigue as they enter that very important stretch in September. So he's going to be very careful. And luckily, he has some pieces that he can work in once in a while to give those guys a break. Aaron Crow and Francisco Bueno and Jason Fraser. And, of course, Bruce Chen is there as your long man and kind of a guy that can fill in anywhere. So he's pretty well fixed there, but he is going to be very careful with those three very important back-end relievers.
Hey, DK, just one last thing for me. I mean, you hear people talk about tough schedule, easy schedule, and when you look ahead with the Royals, they do have a lot of games that they have left on the schedule against teams that are not really in contention anymore. Is there any kind of an internal feeling around the Royals that the schedule could work in their favor?
I don't hear anybody talking about the schedule at all, Phil. These guys are pretty intent on winning every game, and I don't think they're sensing that they have a soft schedule coming up at all. And if you look at it, there are, I think, six games left with Detroit. And so I don't think and Cleveland also has their three games in there with Cleveland. So I don't think there's any sense that this is going to be a powder puff derby down the stretch.
Well, there's going to be a lot of eyes on them down the stretch because obviously a lot of people in baseball are curious to see how the story plays out. Potential for it to be the best story in baseball this year, given the long playoff drought in Kansas City. I want to thank Dick Cagle for joining us.
Why don't we bring in Jason Beck, who knows a lot more about the Tigers than either one of us. Jason, the level of concern on a 10 scale, what is it right now in Detroit?
In Detroit, probably like a 12, I guess. certainly, in the community, it's up there. They've had a lot to worry about up here in recent days outside of sports, with the flooding from earlier in the month and all. But, this is right up there among, on the disaster scales for a lot of guys. I think, this is a position where, a lot of fans never expected they'd see this club. And I think just when you see a team like this struggling to score runs, I think no matter what the pitching is like, the energy level looks down. And I think between the offensive struggles and the losses on the pitching staff, especially in the rotation with Verlander, having to miss that start and Anibal Sanchez on the DL, I think, you watch this team and there's a little bit of a down energy there, kind of a negative energy going on, really.
How would you say, Beck, Brad Ausmus is holding up through all this? Obviously, a rookie manager thrust into a win-now situation, a really, World Series or bust kind of mentality, and this is definitely a challenge for him, given that context and also given the context of it being his first year in this position.
It does seem like he's trying to figure out which buttons to press, or at least which buttons are going to work. I think he's tried some buttons here, and they haven't worked out. You're starting to hear, more signs of frustration out of him, mainly at the offense and kind of just how, no matter what he's tried, and he's tried a few different things, but he's somewhat limited there. No matter what he's tried, he can't seem to get them started on a streak where they're consistently scoring runs. And it's funny because, other people, looking at him from the outside will look at some of the defensive play of late, especially over the last homestand, and say that, that for a lot of people would be a bigger concern because they've had some games where they've looked sloppy, where guys have made defensive mistakes. There's been a couple miscues on fly balls that, honestly would not have happened. I think if Austin Jackson was in center field, at least on one of them, and on another one was just a plain mix-up. And I think there's some concern there. I think Brad's a little bit more forgiving on that part because he's playing some younger players in key spots, especially on that left side of the infield. He's showing more patience there. I think he's more frustrated at the lack of production offensively, especially from some of the veteran hitters.
Hey, Jason, looking at a trade that was made a long time ago now, that Prince Fielder trade, the mean part of me wonders how bad would this be if Prince Fielder was raking home runs in Texas like a healthy Prince Fielder might have been. But then I look at the other side of that trade, and it seems like when you look at a Tiger lineup right now, Ian Kinsler's got to be a guy that's under the gun to get it going. His on-base percentage hovering around 300 for the month of August. First 17 games in August, scored all of four runs. What do you see with Kinsler? I know he's always been an odd player, that kind of unorthodox in the way he goes about things, and just kind of how does he look right now?
You know, right now it just it seems like he's out of his game. I don't think it's a health issue. If it is, they've done a really good job of hiding it, you know, team and player alike. But you just, you know, the swings aren't there, and he's not slashing the gaps nearly the way he used to. And I don't know if that, if opponents are pitching him differently now, having seen what he did over the first half, or if he's starting to try to, you know, take some more, you know, chances and try to do a little bit too much, which seems odd for a veteran player like him to do. I know Brad has tried to do, you know, some different things with him. He tried batting him leadoff, you know, a couple different stints here. Dad hasn't seemed to do a whole lot. He's tried, you know, getting some guys in motion ahead of him. He's tried changing some things up there. And it just, for whatever reason, he's, to me, you know, that's one of, if not the biggest, you know, puzzles remaining about the slump. Because I think, you know, I might be in the minority, but I think Miguel Cabrera is starting to come around, at least from a pure hitting standpoint. But, you know, if he keeps coming up, you know, without a whole lot of guys on base and without a whole lot of, you know, trouble for the pitcher to await, then, you know, there's not a whole lot, you know, that he can do. And I think part of that's on Kinsler to get going again and become that catalyst.
Jason, obviously, you know, you lose Anibal Sanchez and Justin Verlander right when he was starting to get going. Now, that's going to affect your rotation. I don't think anybody expected you know, Buck Farmer and Robbie Ray to have this prominent role at this point in the season. But, you know, to me, the as big as anything is losing Joaquin Soria out of the bullpen. Obviously, he was their big trade deadline pickup there, really beleaguered area for this team. And now they're trying to patch things together. Bring up Jim Johnson, giving him a shot. He had a rough go his first time in a Tigers uniform. Joe Nathan's you know, ups and downs continue, with I guess you call it chin flip gate the other day with the Detroit fans getting on him. What's kind of the state of the bullpen right now with Soria out of the mix?
It's really chaotic, you know, to be honest with you. I mean, you've got your late inning guys set, even if they're all, you know, if they're not all, you know, pitching consistent. But what you lose in Soria is a really versatile arm that Brad felt like he could use anywhere from the seventh inning to the ninth inning to extras and be able to plug him in. You know, not only if guys need the day off, but you could plug him in with guys on base and be able to get a big out. You know, he never really, you know, it took Story a little while to get in the comfort zone. And then once he did, it felt like right after that, you know, he got hurt there in Toronto and you ended up really, I don't know if we've really seen the full value of what Soria can do. But essentially what it did was it put the Tigers back at square one as far as where the bullpen was before that trade, which was having to, you know, use a few key guys, you know, on a regular basis to the point where you were risking wearing them down. And the extra risk there right now is that they're in one of their toughest stretches of the season as far as, you know, games played over a number of days, you know, without a whole lot of off time. Because they've got day-night doubleheaders coming up on back-to-back Saturdays on the road, which means, you know, starting this week, they have a stretch of 24 games in 23 days, and that includes an off day coming up next week. They've got to be able to get some depth out of that bullpen. That's where Jim Johnson comes in. You know, it's not something you see the Tigers. I would have never expected the Tigers to make a move like that and take a flyer on the Jim Johnson at this point in the year. But, you know, really where they're at, they've got to try something. And they see a guy who, you know, the velocity's still there. It's not like he had this massive injury or anything like that. Just, you know, the pitching somehow deserted them. What you have then is, you know, a guy who gets a brief AAA tune-up and now is thrown into a different situation to see if a change of scenery works out. And, you know, we'll find out. I think depending on how long Soria is out, you know, this could be really important for them to see if they can get, you know, any sort of key outings out of this guy.
Well, aside from the bullpen issues and the offense struggling and the rotation getting hurt and some defensive mishaps, sounds like things are going pretty well for the Tigers right now. Certainly a lot of time to turn it around, though, so we'll see if they can climb back to the top of the Central. I want to thank Jason Beck for joining us.
I'm going to be joined today by Jordan Bastian, our excellent Indians beat reporter. We're talking about an Indians team that has positioned itself to do what it did a year ago when it made a sort of an amazing run in September to grab a wild card spot. It's been a back-and-forth season, but you know, the Indians really have positioned themselves for that same kind of a dramatic finish. And rather than have me talk about it, let's bring in Jordan Bastian. And Jordan, I'm just wondering how much confidence or how much, you know, if you can sense a difference in the Indians this year from having had the big finish a year ago. Do you see a carryover?
Well, I think there's definitely a sense in the clubhouse that, you know, they've been in this position before. You know, a lot of these guys, they're still young guys, guys like Jason Kipnis and Michael Brantley, but over the last, not just last season, but the year before that, you know, they've been through some drastic highs and some drastic lows. They weathered a pretty abysmal year in 2012, experienced a pretty incredible turnaround last year, figured out how to, you know, pull themselves together over the final month, really make a push towards a playoff spot and ultimately capture that playoff spot. You know, and then obviously the bitter taste of, you know, one playoff game and then having to go home. So, you know, they have all that experience that they can lean on, and I think that's a good thing, especially because with some of the moves and some of the injuries and inconsistencies that have happened this season, it is a relatively young group. Some of the veterans are no longer there. Guys like Dustin Masterson, Asdrubal Cabrera were traded. David Murphy's injured right now. Nick Swisher is facing knee issues and is out right now. So there's a lot of young guys, a lot of guys who have come up from the minors and have helped fill some holes. You know, but, you know, as they say, with a lot of young teams, sometimes they just don't know any better. You know, and I think right now they're just kind of staying afloat, staying right on the edge of that playoff race, and, you know, hoping and waiting that they can hit their stride here in the last month, just like they did last season.
Yeah, I think what's impressive is how they just kind of keep chipping away. They got to 500 at the All-Star break. You know, they're only, as we talk, a couple games over 500 in the second half, but, you know, they've avoided those long stretches that would have knocked them out. And a lot of big wins, like the one they had in Minnesota, first game of a series there, came back from a 5-0 deficit and to win 7-5 against the Twins. And the thing that struck me, that was a game where Trevor Bauer only went 4 2/3, and Terry Francona absolutely worked that bullpen masterfully. I think it wound up being 8 relievers in that game, Jordan. And you know, what'd you make of all those pitching changes? And that, I mean, it's kind of like showing an urgency to win, and that's what you have to have this time of the year.
Yeah, it was 8 pitchers, 7 relievers used, and that's nothing new for Tito this year. He's actually, in terms of total relief appearances, the Indians are first in the majors by a long shot. It's almost 40 appearances more than the next place team, which is the Rockies. And they're actually on a pace right now to shatter the MLB record for most relief appearances by a team in a single season. So, you know, we call him Tito's bullpen army. He has 8 or 9 guys down there all season long, used 7 in that game in Minnesota. And you're right, he managed, I believe it was the 7th inning of that game where he went through 4 relievers just in that one inning, you know, alternating righty, lefty, playing the matchup and recognizing that it was a really critical inning. And the way what he said was the way the offense battled to get them back in the game and get that lead, you know, he felt that he owed it to them to do everything possible to win that game. But to your point there, I mean, he's managing in August like it's a playoff game. And I think that's the mentality he's taking right now. I think he can't wait till he can get to September 1st and add even more relievers down for his bullpen. But he's managing every single game right now like it's must win, you know. And obviously, Francona will say from the start of the season that every game is a must win. But you don't see him manage it like he did in Minnesota you know, throughout the entire year. So there's definitely that sense right now, both from the coaching staff, from the manager's office, and in the clubhouse, that, you know, they need to kind of keep their foot on the gas and do everything possible to stay in this race and avoid those long losing streaks.
Well, you mentioned Tito's bullpen, Army, and I'm wondering if with the contract extension, Scott Acheson received a field promotion up from private to corporal the other day in the Army. Kind of a nice story of a veteran who has been here, there, and everywhere that now actually has a little bit of contract security.
Yeah, and that's great. He said that's something he's never really had, so it's nice for him to go into the winter and kind of just do his normal off-season routine without worrying about, you know, trying to find a job. And he pitched under Francona in Boston, and I believe it may have been the last week or the last game of their time together in Boston, and Francona told Acheson, you know, hey, you know, I'm going to end up somewhere else, and you can pitch for me again someday. Obviously, the roads convened in Cleveland, and now the partnership is going to be extended. He's been a really valuable, almost what we call almost a utility reliever. He's pitched in every inning from the third inning on, plus extra innings. He's had 17 multi-inning appearances. In those outings, he's had a 0.33 ERA. I mean, this is a guy who has really filled every role in that bullpen, and that's a really valuable veteran to have down there, not only for on the mound, but, you know, they make all the old man jokes because of his graying hair and how long he's been pitching, but it is a good guy for the young relievers, and there's a lot of those in this bullpen, guys like Kyle Crockett, Cody Allen, you know, and they can kind of lean on him and his experience and everything he's gone through, whether it's injuries, whether it's success, failures, pitching in Japan. I mean, this guy's done everything, so he's a valuable member of that bullpen, and, you know, the Indians are thrilled to have him at least through one more season.
Yeah, I guess sticking to that theme, I think he might have been the winning pitcher in this game, or at least appeared in late, an unfamiliar guy to me. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about Chin Chang Lee, who's appeared in that bullpen Army of late.
Yeah, they call him CC Lee, which is kind of funny because, as Indians fans remember, they traded CC Sabathia and they traded Cliff Lee back-to-back Cy Young winners. So, you know, as the baseball gods saw fit, the Indians would wind up with a reliever named CC Lee. But he's been he's a side-armer out of the bullpen, kind of in the mold of Joe Smith, the veteran reliever who they let go over free agency over the winter, who was a key cog the last couple of years. He's a young guy, and the one thing they've always said about him is, at every level he's pitched at, once he's been there for a little while, gotten his feet wet, gotten comfortable, then he's started to excel. And we've seen that of late. He's got that funky delivery, you know, a lot of deception, gets some ground balls, and he's been an effective young arm that they think can be very valuable for years to come. As I mentioned, you know, Joe Smith kind of goes unheralded around baseball, but you look at his numbers and his track record and the type of pitcher he is, and it's kind of that same type of mold. So a guy like CC Lee, a lefty like Nick Hagedon, you know, the lefty Kyle Crockett, you know, some of these kids are really, you know, filling key roles in that bullpen, which has been one of the godsends for this team this season.
Yeah, and just one other thing, the guy calling the shots in that bullpen, Terry Francona, you know, I can't look at the Indians, couldn't do it last year, can't do it this year, without seeing Francona as, you know, the kind of the key ingredient. And, you know, just the success that he had in Boston, you know, with some different kind of teams, and what seemed to me like a real change in mindset, attitude. You know, it seemed like he just brought a lot of positive karma when they were able to hire him last year. Would you agree he's the main man now?
Oh, totally. I mean, I think the culture just entirely shifted when Francona came over to Cleveland. You know, this is a team that, you know, had just come off a really awful 90-plus loss season in 2012. They had the August when they went 5-24, the worst single calendar month in team history that goes back to 1901. So, you know, there was a lot of negatives in Cleveland coming out of that 2012 season. And when Tito came, you know, I think it was, in a way, it was kind of a good recruiting tool because for once it was this high-profile guy that was coming to Cleveland instead of all the high-profile names that have left Cleveland over the years. So he was able to draw, you know, some talent to come to Cleveland with him. Fans can gripe, you know, about Nick Swisher's production of late, but, you know, the fact that as a free agent he signed in Cleveland, I mean, that was a big deal. And that convinced some other guys to come there too. Michael Bourne came after that. Jason Giambi, who, you know, hasn't done a whole lot on the field lately but has been an immense presence in the clubhouse, he signed up. You know, so you saw the dominoes fall once Tito agreed to come to Cleveland, and it's carried over into this season. Obviously, he won Manager of the Year last year. He did a tremendous job also of building his coaching staff, which I think, you know, shouldn't go unnoticed. A good mix of veteran guys with Brad Mills and Sandy Alomar, but then also having some younger coaches and Kevin Cash in the bullpen and Mickey Callaway, who was a organizational promotion from the minor leagues to be their pitching coach, and he's been a great addition to that staff. So a good mix of veterans and younger coaches to you know, work with the players. And, you know, yeah, I think Francona, as you mentioned, just totally changed that culture and has been the guy who has led the way, and the players all run through a wall for him, which is what you want.
Well, definitely one of those two wild card spots in the American League, very much up for grabs, and it's going to be fun to watch the Indians do everything they can to go back to the playoffs this year. Jordan, thank you very much for joining us. And Jose Abreu, guy having a crazy year, but all of a sudden not hitting for the power that he had been lately. He's been interesting to me to watch him. He's been a 300 hitter in August, but hasn't had that home run in at the time of year when the ball normally flies at U.S. Cellular, but still really interesting to me to watch his approach, almost a 400 on-base percentage in August, even though he hasn't really been driving the ball. But just as always, as he's been since opening day of the season, you know, a must-see attraction in the American League. AC, when you look at the White Sox, what's jumping at you these days?
Well, Abreu always jumps out at you, and to your point, yeah, I mean, I guess what's impressive about that is even when the power is not there, the kid's still getting his hits. I think that shows, you know, how well he's adapted to this level. You know, he's not just not just reliant on his power game. There's more there, but you know, the other thing that jumps out to me is, are they going to call up Carlos Rodon, their top draft pick from this past June? And all eyes, I guess, are on, you know, whether or not they bring him up in September, because that would be certainly from the fans' perspective, that would be an intriguing piece to watch develop and grow. Let's bring in another intriguing piece, Scott Merkin, to talk about that. Scott, what's the outlook there as far as giving this kid a shot, you know, in the season's final month?
First of all, I've definitely been called worse. But second of all, I think it would be more a surprise now if he wasn't called up than if he was at this point. I think it wasn't in his, from what I've been told, it wasn't in his contract that, you know, he was guaranteed a shot at September or anything like that. But I think they told him pretty much a form of what they told Chris Sale back in 2010. And Phil probably remembers this as well, that Kenny Williams tells the whole story about how he was in the draft room and looking at another left-handed pitcher kind of warming up in the bullpen for the Sox, not warming up, throwing a bullpen with Don Cooper down on the side. And he kind of turned to Doug Lauman and Nick Hostetler and the other draft experts for the Sox and said, you know, if we draft Chris Sale, he could pitch for us this year. And they kind of looked at him shocked. And Kenny made that point to Chris later that day. And Chris came 2 months after he was drafted to the major leagues as a reliever. Now, from what I've been told, it sounds like Carlos would come up if he did get this chance 100% as a reliever, but I wouldn't be surprised if at some point along the way, like they did with him in Arizona and they did with him more so in Winston-Salem, that they give him, you know, a pitch-held start. You know, let's say you're going out there for 60 pitches, whether that's the first inning or whether that's five innings, that's what you're going to do. But I think he will be there in September, and it'll be interesting because I know they have him at least in the back of their minds, if not the forefront, as part of that rotation in 2015.
Hey, Merk, on that point, I think there are people like our Jim Callis and others who you know, kind of look at baseball as a whole, not one team in particular, and see the White Sox not really in contention, which they were when they brought up Chris Sale, and would say, why would you start a guy that soon? Do you think it's just a matter of they want him to get his feet wet,
get a little bit of confidence that he would take into spring training, get some of the newness out? What would be the purpose from the organization standpoint of taking a look at Rodon in September?
Yeah, I think a little bit on that sense, but this is something that I just think, and this is something that no one has told me on, off, or anywhere in between the record. And I think that this is a guy who they're building this kind of reshape, rebuild, whatever you want to call it, around, along with Sale and Abreu and Micah Johnson and, boy, I'm missing name, Connor Gillespie's in there, Jose Quintana, Jake Petrichka. And I think it's a little shot in the arm for the team in terms of the fan base to say, here's the guy we got. We were lucky enough to get him. You know, a lot of people thought that he was going number one, even, you know, as recent as just a little bit before this draft, or maybe not just a little bit before, but sometime this season, people still had him as pegged as number one. So for him to fall to the Sox at three, it was a great boon. And I think they want to kind of put him on display a little bit. Now, this is only if he's ready. If for some reason he goes, he's starting in Charlotte, he's going to be in Charlotte. If some reason he goes to Charlotte, he'll probably have a chance for three appearances there, and he just looks like that's it, he's hit a wall, then they won't call him. It's not automatic. It's not 100% guaranteed. But I do believe that if he shows he's ready, he'll go up there. And they've shown that in the past with Gordon Beckham, Chris Sale, that, you know, starting that time clock is not as important to them as the player kind of. But Rick Hahn has said a couple of times, he will be up if it best serves his development. So that's what to keep in mind for this year.
Mark, another guy who came up, joined the team this month, and his timetable was quicker than you might imagine, was Vizquel Garcia after that torn labrum injury in April. You figure his year is over. I believe we talked about him recently, you know, making a charge in AAA and looking pretty good on there. Now he joins the big league club. And just from being around him, everything he went through with that experience, what does it seem to have taught him, or what seems to be his outlook here for these last 6 weeks or so?
You know, he was never a downcast guy, if that's even a word. He never seemed, you know, sullen or anything like that, but he really seems even more so upbeat. And I can go back to when I sat with him to do an interview with him for our Father's Day story, I guess it was back in June. And when he first said, you know, I'm going to come back this year, and I kind of did a double take, and he said, no, that's my hope. And I think he's been upbeat since. And this is quite a fight that he's put through here. And, you know, credit to White Sox head athletic trainer Herb Schneider and Brian Ball, the assistant, and the many doctors that have worked with him, just the team in general. But a lot of credit to Avisa Yield, not only just the physical work he put in to get healthy, but how about the baseball work to where the guy who hadn't seen live pitching aside from a simulated game since April 9th when he got hurt diving for the fly ball in Colorado, to hit 340 with Colorado and have hits in his first two games back with the White Sox and look like he never missed a step. And that's a credit to all the intense baseball work that he put in along with the rehab work. As Robin said, you know, first guy in, last guy to leave during this whole, you know, four-month process. And he deserves a ton of credit. And he seems ready to go. I think he's very excited that he's going to get this month and a half. And no more excited than the White Sox, who, you know, have been able to answer questions themselves. And obviously, he'll be able to answer questions in his mind as to how he was going to respond to this kind of injury that, you know, the table was set at 3 to 6 months for return. So there'll be no doubts going into spring training next year. He's going to have 6 weeks of a bat, 6 weeks of primarily playing right field to see what he can be. And, you know, it's a great plus for the White Sox to have him either, you know, batting fourth behind Abreu, or Robin has even talked about having him hitting second because of the way he can move and his, you know, his style that he would fit in front of Abreu also. So it's really kind of left him with a huge positive mental outlook, and rightfully so. I mean, this is a I don't want to say incredible, but a really admirable comeback the way he fought to get back this season.
Mark, how do you see the outlook for the White Sox possibly doing a waiver trade or two before the month of August is out? I mean, we haven't heard a whole lot about their players in those sort of trade talks, but it seems like they have a lot of veterans at the end. You know, the guy that jumps out, of course, is Adam Dunn. But, you know, beyond him, you know, there's some other guys. Do you think they could still be a seller here before August is over?
Yeah, Rick Hahn has said a number of times that they plan to be, you know, active in August. Now, you know, it's halfway through August and they haven't done anything yet, but there hasn't been a ton of August moves quite yet either. I think, you know, as another week goes by, another 10 days goes by, I think teams will start to see really and truly if, you know, the teams that are on the fringe right now, if they're still in it, if they still need a guy like Dunn who can reach the fences, who can get on base, who can, you know, make an impact with the bat to add to the lineup. And then you basically just have a month left of his salary. it'll be a good thing for Adam. I talked to him the other day, and he, you know, kind of indicated that this may be it for him. This may be his last year. The man has never played in the playoffs. You know, great clubhouse guy, great influence overall. Anthony's covered him before too, and I think it would be cool for him to get a chance to really fight for the playoffs. Now, he had that in 2012 with the White Sox and Robbins' first year, and they came up short with a poor finish. But it would be good if some team that was really in it gave him a chance, if a deal could be worked out.
Not just any of us who have gotten to know Adam Dunn over the years, certainly rooting for him to get that shot. Never been a part of the postseason, and still value in that bat. You kind of know what you're getting at this point. You know, some boom or bust there, but you'll take the boom, I think, in today's game. So we'll see what he decides at year's end, but we'll see what the White Sox decide with him this month. Let's bring in Rhett Bollinger to talk about that. And Rhett, how big of a shot in the arm was that to see Nolasco, you know, make a strong return? And I think, as Phil says, trying to kind of salvage things here in these last few weeks. What are the expectations for him?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a big thing. Nolasco was brought in this offseason on a deal that was the biggest free agent signing in the club's history, you know, $49 million over 4 years with an option for a fifth year. And they thought, you know, based on his track record and his strong year last year with the Dodgers down the stretch after playing with the Marlins after a trade, that he'd be, you know, the anchor of that rotation. And truthfully, he just really hasn't. Really, he dealt with an elbow injury all year, started kind of dealing with it, you know, pretty early in the season, but didn't say anything. Thought it was just kind of thing he could pitch through. Ended up getting worse and worse and kind of realized that it wasn't a good thing to pitch through anymore. Ended up kind of getting diagnosed with an elbow strain, won the DL there for, you know, almost a month there, and came back, you know, six innings. He had one bad inning in that start. But other than that, you know, he looked a little bit better. His velocity was better. The biggest thing was, he said after that start that he felt healthy for the first time all year. So you got to figure that he's got to pitch better down the stretch. I mean, his track record suggests that he's not this bad. Because, you know, like I said, he does have an ERA, you know, near six right now. So the Twins are hopeful that he'll kind of get it together, and he should. I mean, like I said, based on his track record, he's certainly not this bad of a pitcher. If they can get him on track down the stretch, it would help to go along with guys that have been good all year, like, you know, Kyle Gibson and Phil Hughes. And obviously now they're giving a look to a guy like Trevor May. So they're hopeful the rotation kind of can, you know, still be strong going down the stretch a little bit, which wasn't really the case the last couple of years where they scuffled down the stretch because, you know, they kind of had some fill-in starters, that kind of stuff. At least now they kind of feel like they have a little bit more of a, you know, a solidified rotation, I guess you could say, so they don't kind of get in one of these, you know, late-season finals like they had the last couple of years.
Hey, Red, I know it's a good thing you're a big strapping fella yourself, because you look at the Twins these days. Kenny's Vargas, promoted from Double-A. He's listed at 6'5", 275. I mean, just how big is this guy? I mean, he seems like, I don't even know exactly what the parallel would be. You go back, I don't think a young David Ortiz, you know, had that sort of bulk when he arrived back in Minnesota years ago. Just how big is Vargas?
I mean, he's huge. That's the thing. He's bigger than Ortiz was, too. I mean, he's taller. He's just a huge guy, just a mammoth of a man and a ton of power. I mean, could even be watching him batting practice from both sides of the plate. This switch hitter is crushing the ball, you know, up in the seats at Target Field every time he takes batting practice. And so far, you know, in the time that he's been called up, he's been hitting the ball really well, you know, up here too. I mean, he had a home run the other day, you know, hitting doubles, hitting for power. Still striking out a decent amount, but that's to be expected, you know. When you get called up from Double-A, you don't really have any experience past that. You can expect some strikeouts, but I mean, the power's there. Even, you know, hitting the ball the other way a little bit, driving in some runs. Gardenhire really has been really, you know, high on him. They want to keep using him as kind of DH down the stretch, keep on seeing what they have in him. It obviously helps you to have Joe Mauer back. They've been kind of batting Joe Mauer at third and then Vargas right behind him at, you know, cleanup hitter. And Vargas has been doing really well with runners on base, and Mauer's been truthfully great since he came back from the DL, which is also another big boost for this team. Kind of like the last go to have, you know, Mauer come back, and Vargas has been driving him in, and definitely has been a big part of the offense recently. And the Twins are kind of excited about that. Obviously, it's been a small sample size, but the Twins do believe that he can be, you know, a DH type slash part-time first baseman, you know, kind of the future, and bring that much needed power to the lineup. And so far, to the Twins, you know, thrill, I guess you could say, that he actually has done it so far in the few weeks that he's been up here.
Right, you alluded to you know, what Mauer has done season back. And it's a small sample, but you know, with everything he's dealt with the back and the oblique, you know, to come back and presumably be healthy and looks like he's controlling the controlling the strike zone like he did in years past, like Joe Mauer we're used to seeing. I mean, you think, again, I know it's a small sample, but you think he's kind of turned a corner here offensively and health-wise?
Yeah, it sure seems like it. Yeah, it sure seems like it. I mean, he's grabbing the ball the other way with authority like he always does. You know, hit a home run the other night, you know, the left field, hit another ball that right off the wall. Nice play by Alex Gordon of the Royals to rob him of another double. So, I mean, he's definitely been hitting the ball really hard. Good sign. He's pretty much all the way back from that injury. He's still taking care of it. He does this thing now where he, before the games now, he'll even take some swings right-handed to kind of get his oblique a little bit loosened up. But, yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, Joe Mauer's always, you know, his whole career he's always been a hitter. And this, you know, year he really truthfully struggled, you know, before that injury uncharacteristically. But so far since he came back, it's a small sample. But at the same time, it's Joe Mauer. I mean, he came back looking like Joe Mauer, and that's a good sign. And you got to figure with a guy like him, he's going to figure it out and put it back together, too, the rest of the season. So that'll be a big boost for them. But the hard thing was that, you know, kind of earlier in the season when they, you know, they were kind of 500 kind of early in the year, kind of going along, hanging in there, maybe had a chance to surprise some people. Mauer really wasn't really a part of that. He really wasn't the old Joe Mauer, and that kind of hurt them a little bit. But I do think the Twins would like to see him kind of get back into form here late in the year and obviously carry it over into next season where maybe he'll be more comfortable at first, be more healthy next year, and then have another big year. Because it's just at this point, he's just kind of trying to salvage this year.
We've talked before about the tough year in the farm system for the top prospects, but it just doesn't seem to end in 2014 for Byron Buxton. A lot of organizations, number one prospect coming into this year, promoted after he got back on the field battling those wrist injuries, and then big collision in the outfield. His first game in Double A. What's the outlook for him to get back from that, or is that going to be? I think it was wound up being a concussion. Is this pretty much going to be the last straw for this season at this point?
The Twins haven't said yet, but it was definitely a scary incident. It was his first game too. You know, it's one of the season just been. To me, he's been cursed a little bit. Obviously, he had the wrist injury in spring training on a just a dive. Diving play in spring training, and he missed, a couple months, comes back, immediately slides at home and re-injures his wrist, and then, finally gets back up to Double A. In his first Double A game, gets in a, violent collision where, from what I was told from the Twins, he was unconscious for nearly 10 minutes on the field. They had to take him in, an ambulance to the hospital where he was hospitalized overnight. But luckily, no broken bones, none of that stuff. Just a concussion, which is obviously still a very scary thing, and just some overall stiffness, I think, in his body from the collision, which was very scary. But the good news is that, like I said, he didn't break any bones or anything like that. But, yeah, the Twins are going to be careful with him the rest of the season. There's only a few more weeks left in the minor league season anyway. So I'd probably be surprised if, he gets back out there just because it did look like such a violent collision. But the thing with, concussions, you never really know how quickly you'll bounce back from one. We saw guys, like, especially with the Twins, they've had a pretty bad history with those, with Justin Morneau. His career kind of got derailed there for a little while. Obviously, Mauer's concussion last year changed his career course to first base. Denard Span, when he was here, had concussion problems. So they've definitely dealt with it. But there's also been guys, Trevor Plouffe, Aaron Hicks, some of these guys who had concussions that bounced right back within a week. So you never really know the severity of it or if he's had them in the past. But I think the Twins are going to be careful. I probably would say he's probably not going to play in the minor league season, but if he can kind of get through this, I'm guessing the Twins would definitely like to try to get him to the Arizona Fall League to kind of keep him, in there and get him some at-bats, that kind of thing. But really, I think right now it's just the Twins are just kind of in a waiting period, just kind of letting him relax here. And they sent him back to Fort Myers where the team trains because that's where all the team trainers are and they can kind of keep a watchful eye on him and monitor his progress. So for now, it's just kind of a waiting game and no rush and make sure that, Bucks is okay because, anytime you have a brain injury like that, it's always a scary thing.
Well, Rip, thank you very much. That's been MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. For my partner in crime, Anthony Kastrovitz, this is Phil Rogers saying thanks for listening.